Anão. Sociologia e Utopia.
Bem-vindos e bem-vindas ao 12º episódio do podcast Ainda Não, Sociologia e Utopia. O convidado de hoje é Peter Maio, professor na Universidade de Malta e Chair em Educação de Adultos da Unesco. Peter, what are your biggest concerns at the moment?
Well, the concerns are many. They are legion, as you can imagine. But two things stand out. My major concern is the struggle against all kinds of exploitation, which means I have to take a very, very, very deep look at my own myself. How much do I exploit others in my day-to-day living, you know, without realizing or maybe, you know, doing much about it. Also my own family relations, for example. And the other major concern for me is that whatever utopia I think of, we need utopia, is that everything we think of in terms of a socially just world, has to transcend, has to go beyond the present framework of capitalism. I think we have to start thinking, I don't want to use the word outside the box, because it's a cliche, but we have to think about things that transcend capitalism. Unless we do that, we are stuck with the same system. And as you know, capitalism, even though we benefit from it in our living, etc., this is our life, is essentially a very exploitative system. No bones about it. We have not yet reached governed by relations which are not exploitative. We had the feudal system, we have capitalism, and I think this also has its time. And it will be changed, not in our lifetime, of course, but it will be. It will, like all other systems. The other major concern for me is, and this is connected to what I said, is the end of racism. That is extremely important. I've been writing about this from my own standpoint, which is not different from yours, being in Portugal, from a Southern European perspective. As you know, you are on the Atlantic, but very close to the Mediterranean. We are supposedly in the middle of the Mediterranean, Malta, although you can travel from one end to the other without even hitting Malta because it's so small. But we've seen a lot of tragedies in many parts of the world, not just in our part. In our part, it is across the central Mediterranean route. But we see the same thing from Mexico, from Latin America into the United States. You find it everywhere. And my fear is that brings me to the third point. There are others, but these are the three key ones, because this is interrelated, is the issue of the environment, the global environment, and therefore, what this means is the whole idea of, just to give an example, how to save the planet, but most important of all, as an ingredient of as part of this process, is the idea of climate change, which is making people in certain parts of the world, invariably the most impoverished parts, as always is the case, people have no other options in terms of living to migrate. And by migrating, because of many reasons, unbearable climate, which is going to get worse, I've been told, throughout the century. The heat rise was 1.5, it will go up to even 4.5, I've been told. And this has been written, I understand, in scientific journals by the end of the century. This is going to be tremendous. And I think when it comes to migration, if things remain as they are in the foreseeable future, we ain't seen nothing yet, because this is going to escalate. And it's going to escalate and continue to consolidate also through migration, the north-south this north-south binary, the unequal exchange between north and south. You're going to have people have to leave certain southern parts, move elsewhere, creating all kinds of disruptions in terms of population. For a small country like Malta, where an influx of so many migrants, which might mean nothing even in a country like Portugal, but for us could have an effect. The problem is not the migrant, the problem is the economic system in the world economic system. So all these are interconnected, and therefore, we must start thinking sociologically outside the idea of the imperial north-south dimension. This is a tall order, but I expect to see a lot of sociological research around this area. It's already happening, but I would like to see this escalate. So these are my major concerns. We know why people migrate. We know some of the reasons why. First of all, of course, unequal distribution of resources. Most resourceful parts of the world have been ravaged through imperialism, through many, many other things, which is still going on, by the way. Takes a different form, okay? Neo-colonialism and all those kind of things. You've got also indigenous factors like female mutilation, genital mutilation, and of course, conflicts between countries, often also now because of the effect of climate change, which will have and the greenhouse effect, which will also have an effect on resources. So some countries in the south are going to lose a lot of resources, and this will fomented by a Western-based arms industry will foment wars over resources, which has always been the case, wars over resources. And people are going to migrate, etc., to escape the horrors.
What the sociology and also critical education can do to analyze and transform some of these concerns?
I tend to lean towards qualitative research, sociology. And one thing is, you can either use theory and revise that theory according to your particular area of investigation. Or alternately, do grounded theory where you start with the area and then create the theory. I just marked a PhD thesis on this. So these are, but how does this research, therefore, transfer into the public sphere? I think many sociologists are role models in this. We've had lots of sociologists. We call them sociologists engagés. I mean, Pierre Bourdieu is one of them. I mean, there are many others who write also. I think we also have to write not only in academic pieces, but use our insights or what derives from our research in articles for general, I don't like to use the word consumption. I'm very careful the language I use. Like when I talk about students, I talk about catchments, but I don't use the word markets in higher education, for example. I'm very careful about that because one of the way of fighting capitalism is avoiding its own lingo, its own language. Sometimes we use this all the time. We use this, especially at universities. You can see the corporate sector having an effect on the life of the life world of the university. I try to stick to the principles of the life world rather than allow it to be dominated by the capitalist system world. However, I should write more in Maltese newspapers, for example, but I go for a much more general public sphere. So when I have something which is the bee in my bonnet, and I've thought about it, or maybe carried out research about it, what I do is I write an opinion ed in English, because that's my strength. You write according to what you're strong in. I've often written in Italian, I've often written in Maltese as well. I normally find a Counterpunch, which is an open access online outlet, very useful as a conduit to be able to reach people involved in what I call the global public sphere in the English language. So this is how hegemony works. You know, English is hegemonic, but by English I can communicate with other people. I can communicate to many people in Portugal without having to write Portuguese, because I can't write Portuguese. I can understand it, but not write it. So I do that. Some people are much better than I am in this regard. For example, my colleague, Carmel Borch, with whom I have co-written books, as I have co-written with others, he's very good, for example, in terms of the Maltese public sphere. He's very much the face of our faculty. He's always on, he's on television, etc. And I'm sure you have the same people in Portugal. I don't know, is Boaventura de Santos that kind of person who appears on television, you know? It used to be the French tradition in that respect. So I think we need to do this more, and I need to do this more. As I said, I get engaged in podcasts and also writing, not just Counterpunch, but Counterpunch is the one I find most accessible for me to write and read as well. I learned a lot from it. The other outlet, I was introduced to it by my friend Henry Giroux, who was involved in the, I think he's one of the directors, was Truth Out. But I find a Counterpunch a much easier conduit for this sort of things. And then I will never give up an opportunity to give an interview. For example, Open Democracy was a wonderful experience I had, and we're going to hopefully do another thing there, etc. So this is where I operate. Of course, if the topic is something I'm concerned about, I will accept to be interviewed or give a talk publicly or interviewed on the media, only if it is something I'm really deeply concerned about. Because I know it is also becoming very fashionable for the media. Here in Malta, we have I don't know how many radio stations, and they want to fill up. And I don't want to be used simply, you know, for other people to make money, basically, out of my academic labor, which is not going, about issues that which are not of deep concern to me. And I know it's very easy for people, that's the cheapest program to create. But if it is the bee in my bonnet, if it is very much concerned, I will be the first even to suggest this to my contacts within the media, which are not very big. I used to work in the media. My first job was as a journalist for an Arab finance newspaper in the English language. It was a part-time work while I was studying to become a teacher, actually. And, I learned a lot from it. As I grew older and I look back on some of the advice, which probably I was arrogant enough not to take on board, but I realized how good it was. And so I have a bit of experience there. Of course, then I used to interview people. Now, often I'm being interviewed rather than interview. And that's because of my role as an academic. So, yes. I'm sure there are, you play to your strengths. I mean, people have different strengths. I love interviews. I love giving interviews now, not just interviewing people, but giving interviews and writing. Those are my strengths. You know, I mean, other people are, I don't like television a lot because I'm very self-conscious. You know, I mean, just look and you can see, you might have a nightmare when you see my face. But anyway, whatever it is, I feel confident there. But it's okay if it's a worthwhile cause, I'll do it. And also I often help out for free NGOs. If I first have to study that NGO. Not all NGOs are progressive. Mm-hmm. When we talk about civil society, not the way Gramsci understood the word. Connection. The way it's been used today, we tend to turn it into some kind of panacea, probably because of the lack of interest in left-wing political parties, very few of them exist, which are really genuinely. I mean, parties which were once socialists have become really neoliberal. You name it. All right, we have the same thing in Malta. I mean, the Labour Party is anything but a Labour Party, as far as I'm concerned. I don't mind saying this. We tend to go, therefore, we have this new Deus Ex Machina, which is the social movements, one has to tread carefully here. The so-called civil society also includes right-wing groups, even terrorist groups who use the internet, etc. That's how they recruit. And there's an educational, quote-unquote, process taking place there. You know, that's how do you recruit, even would-be terrorists. No, but if it's a very progressive social NGO, and where you can see people giving of their time and their life to a cause without earning anything, actually more forking out, then I always give anything they ask me for free. I do that. So, and I always support this, the NGOs. For example, even I've been invited to places. I told them, hang on a minute, I've got my own, I can pay my own airfare. And, I do it. I'm very careful about that. On the other hand, maybe one has to be very careful also that you don't become an object of exploitation. There's a lot of academic exploitation taking place. But, so I am very careful who to answer. To answer, of course, if it's going to be somebody from the corporate sector, I probably refuse. If it's somebody which is publicly funded, but which makes money, but they could be useful, then I'm going to charge. But I don't do that to most of the NGOs who invite me, those that I believe in and those whose concerns I share, and therefore whose cause I commit myself to. I do this as part of my, I don't know, call it mission, call it vocation, I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
The last question is, what utopias guide your action and your thoughts? What are...
Utopia. Utopia is... Everybody talks about, well, some people talk about utopia. Paulo Freire talks about utopia. Henri Giroux talks about utopia. Utopia is something we need. I remember Frei Beto, very well known to Portuguese listeners and readers, Carlos Alberto Libanio Cristo. And I asked him a question about the ideology of ideological death. You say there's, you know, this is Paul, I'm quoting Paulo Freire here. I believe from the book, one of his 1998 books, I think was Pedagogia d'Autonomia. I'm not sure. I may stand to be corrected, whatever. And Paulo Freire said this, the ideology of ideological death, that basically we've been told we have reached the end of history, which is, and I asked this to Frei Beto, I said, this is stupid. He said, I am sure he's always positive, Frei Beto. This is a guy who was arrested twice as a student leader. He said, we will soon have a movement to rescue utopias. The idea of utopia today in many parts has been set aside and shut down. Well, there are utopias and utopias. In literature, they used to talk about fancy and imagination. It was Coleridge in the preface to the Lyrical Ballads. Something which is like a Peter Pan kind of stuff. Or alternatively, a dream which is rooted in one's existential situation. And that's the kind of utopia I believe in. Of course, you need a utopia. I told you earlier on, what I believe in is a situation, a utopia, if you like, which transcends the present framework. When you are thinking outside the present framework, therefore, your ultimate vision from which your criticism emerges and your possibilities emerge, your alternative discourse emerges, what the Germans call an integral part of critique, which has both criticism and possibility. That's why I don't like the word critique and possibility, because critique assumes that. Then you have a utopia, because basically you are starting from a vision which is very much removed by what is happening today, but it is something which can happen, something which is not yet, but it can happen. It can happen not in your lifetime, but it can happen. And you work towards it happening, but it doesn't depend only on you. It doesn't depend only on education. Let's not give education powers it does not have. Paulo Freire said this, and many people say this. This was ABC for us in sociology of education. For my very first exposure, education, it was at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. I have to say this, and I want to thank my teachers for this. Education does not change things on its own. It can only change things if it's part of a larger constellation of forces, of movements, if you like. Then, yes, you need education. You need that. That's a very important ingredient. But one part depends on others. It is not, as a sociologist, I would say, it is not a... it's a variable, but it is dependent on other variables. I have a blockage, my age. There's a simple word which cannot come to mind. Okay, and I've been writing about this so several times, and I use this phrase, and it just come to my mind right now. It is not an independent variable. This is it. Education, this is the word, the phrase. It is not an independent variable. And it depends on so many other factors. So to expect, which is what politicians do, by the way. Many politicians that I know, let me not tar everybody with the same brush, because they have no idea of political economy and they have no idea of sociology, I would say. They don't have a social imagination because they operate within the system. Okay, and I'm also including many, many, many who supposedly are on the left. They tend to give education becomes the panacea for them. But education plays an important part in utopia. Now, utopia means also, like Paulo Freire, that despite all the tribulations, despite all the suffering, I mean, we cannot say that Paulo Freire did not suffer so many years of exile in a country which was roused for transformation, but then stopped by a CIA engineered coup. You can't say he was not a positive person. He did not lose heart, pedagogy of hope. He spoke about hope. Hope and utopia go together. Henry Giroux wrote a very good paper in a special issue of Postcolonial Directions in Education, the journal I edit, co-edit. And he talks about, it is all about hope. And he harkens back to Pedagogia de Esperanza. I don't know, in Portuguese, like Spanish, Esperanza means to wait for somebody and also to wait with hope, esperar. I don't know if this is the same in Portuguese. In Spanish, they have double meaning. I wait for you, te espero.
Yeah,
you go to the servicio, the washroom. I wait for you outside, but also is also hope. And the two are connected because there's an element of waiting, not yet. So we have it. So utopia cannot be completely like we do with small children, unfortunately, a beautiful world, which is very difficult to realize. No, it has to be something which you can realize, but you have to change conditions, and therefore this is a lengthy process. But this is the thing about the mind. The mind is like art. It can create. If you are in theater, you know this. You can do many things in theater, which you cannot do in real life, but it is based on the concerns in real life. And that's why theater can be, as you know, theater can be such an important, such a powerful, potent force for transformation. I mean, you don't have to go only to the Freirean kind of theater like Boal does. You go to some of the greatest theater people in the history, from Shakespeare, I don't know about the Spanish theater people like, but Federico Garcia Lorca for sure. And he did it. He used theater as a pedagogical mission, as a part of a pedagogical mission, cultural mission with Eduardo Ugarte. But there are others. Karl Marx's daughter, who was an actress herself, worked with George Bernard Shaw. She was English because she was born in England. She believed a lot that a lot of her father's ideals could be realized through, could be promoted through theater. Okay, and of course Bertolt Brecht is well known for having done this, etc. So you can create this kind of either dystopia or utopia. If you know somebody like Samuel Beckett is writing, correct me if I'm wrong, I know you're into theater, is writing in the post-war years. He's not writing about the war, but he's capturing the climate where all the certainties have gone out of the window, have gone up in smoke. You begin to question everything. But he's still waiting for Godot. His characters, the tramps, are still waiting for Godot, to the point that even though we know that Godot's not going to turn up towards the end, he keeps, one of them keeps saying, was it Ostragon or the other one? He keeps saying, what do we do tomorrow? Oh, we come here, forward, to wait for Godot. Ah, you know, that sort of thing. There is always that forlorn hope. Now, you can read what you like into that. Okay? You could take a cynical attitude and say, look at that, despite everything. Yeah. Or you can say, listen, despite everything, something rises from the ashes, from a dystopia into clinging to a utopian view. Depends on one's interpretation. Because primarily it's very dystopian, the play. So, yeah, utopia is the possibility, the dream, the possibility, but rooted in your existential situation. It has to be rooted in human beings. It has to be rooted in the rest of nature, because we are also part of nature. We're not apart. You cannot create a different kind of nature or a different human being never heard of. That, for me, is fancy. That's not utopia. Utopia is in the relation how things can be different in terms of economic things. Now, for me, my utopia would be a world, there's a lot what I can think of right now is a world where relations between different, not just human beings, but different aspects of the world, of nature, if you like, live in harmony. Paulo Freire used to talk about unity in diversity. I talk about harmony in biodiversity. I prolong, it is not just social diversity, but it's also biodiversity, of which the social forms an integral part. But it is also harmony, because harmony is not a suffocating cap. You can be unit. There could be unity, and sometimes you need unity against certain kind of phenomena, or situations in life. You need unity, but you also need harmony, because the word harmony also respects the individual within the individual, however, within a collectivity. In harmony. So I prefer that word. I prefer the mantra of harmony in biodiversity. And I've written about this and even revised Paulo Freire's, in relation to Paulo Freire, actually. And of course, and probably when you read Paulo Freire, that is what he's getting at, more than unity in diversity. I would say harmony in biodiversity. But it's not formulated, at least in English, this way. Sometimes, you know, as you probably know, as speaking Portuguese, I think a lot of Paulo Freire gets lost in translation into English. Mm-hmm. I am not trying to denigrate or devalue, detract from the sterling work that Mayra Bergman Ramos did in her translation alongside Paulo Freire in Massachusetts when they were preparing the translation of Pedagogia do Oprimido, which, remember, was the first time it was published, because they couldn't publish it in Portuguese. It was also published in Spanish in Uruguay, in Montevideo. But the manuscript, Pedagogia do Oprimido, which the Paulo Freire Institute produced. I have a copy of it actually in manuscript form, could not be published. She did a very good job because she was also very close to Paulo. Paulo was all the time with her. So I'm not trying to detract from that, but in later books, I do find words which, you know, they don't fit in the English language. And then I have a problem. Pedagogia da Tolleranzia, which is a posthumous book. I mean, I used to ask Paulo Freire's colleague, Moacir Gadotti, but does the tolleranzia have a different meaning from the English tolerance? Because tolerance for us is a condescending attitude in English. I don't like that. That's not Freirean as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, so my utopia would be, yes, harmony in biodiversity. That's my utopian vision. Well, I think that phrase captures it all. Harmony in biodiversity. And then you can open up chapters and volumes on this. But yes, that will be my utopian vision. And an eco-socialist vision. An eco-socialist vision, which also is not just a question. And that's what I argue here, is we need to read Marx carefully, Marx in holistically. I haven't read all of his work, but I've read quite a chunk, including those parts which were written by Engels, especially when it comes to the environment. It's not just a question about social relations, but also human-earth relations. And that's extremely important. The exploited are not just human beings, but it's the whole universe around capitalism, which is exploitative, which also exploits nature in general, including humans.
Ainda não. Sociologia e utopia.